That Bellevue contingent is here, and my name is Don. I'm an alcoholic, and I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing today. I haven't had a drink or thought of a drink, and that's all that takes. My current home group is the Denver Thursday Night Group. We meet in Denver every Thursday night at about 8 o'clock. And I say current home group because I'm a believer in the home group. But I also know from life experience that I change and groups change. And you move sometimes or things happen. And while I'm still a member of that group, 2 years ago I was a member of the Southern Pines Tuesday Night Big Book group. But tonight I belong to the Denver Thursday Night group. That's where you'll find me on Thursday night unless something really important has come up. Usually a death in the family. I was told that that can only be mine. So, I don't fully believe that, but I'll go along with it. I want to bring you greetings from my mother and my wife. See, I should be home today. This is Mother's Day. But because of you, the ladies in my life have an understanding that goes beyond mine. A couple years back, several years back, I was privileged to be serving you as trustee at large, and I was at large, as Dan knows. I was everywhere but home all the time. My grandmother died, my mother's mother died, and I had some place I had to be for Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was on a Wednesday or a Thursday, and I ran down to Mom's, and I said, I'll just cancel the weekend. And she said, don't do that. I said, Mom, I'll just cancel the weekend. She said, listen, the funeral's Monday. I'm all right. See, we're not afraid of death in my family. We don't like dying much, but death's all right. She said, would you be back by Monday? And I said, yeah, I'll be back by Monday. She said, then you go. You have an obligation to the living, and I'll be okay. And I do. My obligation is to the living, because my life was given back to me as a free, clear gift, December 26th of 1967. And then I was brought to you, hand-carried and delivered to you, so that we might turn this gift into something meaningful and useful and shiny and worth something. And you've done that for me. So I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to tell you the truth. Alcoholics Anonymous did not get me sober. God got me sober. 5 months later, he brought me to you. And I figure anywhere God brings me, that's where I'm going to just stick around and see what's going on. And I wasn't supposed to come here. At the time that you found me, I was certified by one government agency as a sociopath type 2. Bad business. Don't know what it is. Don't want to know. I just know it ain't good. One government man said I was a psychopath. The psychiatrist said that I was a manic depressive drug addict. The truth was, I was 133 pounds scared. And didn't feel good that morning. My alcoholism is of a type that was so well hidden nobody could see it. Not even me. And as I look back over my life, I'm amazed because no matter what, alcohol was a part of my life. when I was the super insurance salesman, I went through that period, going to be super straight, on a little debit. I sold either $700,000 or $800,000 worth of new life premium on a debit in a seven-month period. I was on the way to getting into the Millionaires Club my first year. Before I got that far, I had to take my last paycheck and put it into the company and leave town because I hadn't learned that the money wasn't mine until it had been through their books. Went to Kansas City. Trunks go to either Kansas City or San Francisco, don't they? Went to work for an IBM training school, and in 3 months I was the sales director. And in 6 months I didn't have a family. And I was back on the street. We didn't know why. The screaming question of my life was always, what's wrong with me? But we didn't see alcohol. It was too much a part of my life. When I was super straight, I was drinking. When I was super freak, I was drinking. I somewhere made a decision that since I could never really be super straight, I decided to be super freak. I am one of the freaks that came out of Berkeley in the 60s, throwing Owsley's acid around, screaming out, where there's dope, there's hope, burn down City Hall. I'm an old speed freak. I am not a drug addict. I'm an old speed freak. I'm an alcoholic who had some problem with drugs, and that's all we need to talk about that. But I say that because some of you need to know what you are. This deal will work for anybody, but it has to have a foundation of truth. And so in the group I come from, we spend enough time to help you find out what you are. And all we can help you find out for sure is, are you alcoholic? The book Alcoholics Anonymous is magnificent in that all of the symptoms of alcoholism are laid out so clean and clear that if you are one, you can't miss it. And if you are one of the type that still can miss it, we have a guaranteed way for you to find out for sure after you've been with us for a little while. We will suggest that you go try a little more controlled drinking. And rarely has anybody I've made that suggestion to done it. The panic hits. That's all they need. They can say, I could never do that. Well, there you are. So I was brought to you. Alcohol did some interesting things for me. I think if mayonnaise would have done it, I'd have probably had too much mayonnaise. But what alcohol did was change me. When I came to alcohol needing to be changed, I don't know whether I was 15 or 16, but I desperately needed to be changed because I didn't fit in. I come from a functional home. My parents are all still alive. My little brother is a professor of music at the University of Colorado and probably the foremost synthesizer jazz musician in the world. They call him all over the world. He just got back from Russia to do his thing. He grew up right down the hall from me. Next room over. My little sister, God bless her, she retired a while back from IBM as one of their top executives. Made really good money and really great babies. And her babies have been busy making great babies. But because the young men of today are mostly idiots, we have not been able to find good husbands for most of those babies. But in my family, the attitude when one of those babies shows up is, oh, isn't that nice? There's another little Pritz baby. Let's raise it. That's where I come from. And if you'd have asked me to please tell us what kind of a family you wish you'd have been raised in, that's the one I got raised in. despite some problems that the human condition brings on, I wouldn't change a thing. But I didn't fit. I thought maybe my people had left me here and would be back from outer space someday and pick me up. I didn't feel like you human beings felt. I didn't think like you said you thought. You had all these high morals and standards, and I didn't. You tell me you ought not do that, it's bad, and it sure looked good to me. I was furious most of the time. I tracked down the simplicity of when I got furious once. I really got pissed and stayed that way. And I know when it happened. I can't tell you the day, but I know exactly when it happened. Somebody said no to me and made it stick. That's when it happened. I have the kind of ego who says, that's mine. It's all mine. If it isn't nailed down, it's mine. If it's nailed down, I've got a claw hammer. I am, at my heart, selfish and self-centered, which causes me to be dishonest and greedy, and a number of other things, but I want mine now. And the alcoholic mind that I carry has a terrible dilemma. You may recognize it. The alcoholic war cry is, where's mine? That can't be mine. It's not big enough. It's the wrong color. There's not enough of it. Okay? And that was my approach to life. Well, you can imagine the conflicts I ran into along the way. So by the time I was 15, I was a mess. As a rite of passage where I come from, we got the guys from Maury Air Force Base to buy us a bottle of whiskey. And we took it out east of Denver to drink it and get drunk and have fun, because that's what they said it would do. Take this, go out east of town, drink it, and have fun. And it changed me. I must tell you, I believe that I have always known that my answer would be spiritual in nature. But I have always been a spiritual thief. Taking from the outside and putting it in here so I would feel better. I thought that's what the spiritual life was about, was feeling good. If you're kind of new here today, please don't be deluded. When we talk about spiritual awakenings, we talk about them like they felt good. Please don't think that's so. Well, that's a whole other trip. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is my basic text, it's the one that I was given, it's the one I use today, because it has all the answers I've ever needed. I've read other books, and they all confirm what the big book says. But that's all they do for me, to confirm it. In that book, The Spiritual Awakening and a Spiritual Experience, what it looks like, tastes like, feels like, is described over and over and over and over, so I don't miss it. Now, what happened to me the first time I took a bottle of whiskey out east of Denver and drank it was that I had what Carl Jung describes as a spiritual awakening. It felt just like that. Ideas and emotions that were once the guiding forces in the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and an entire new set of conceptions begins to dominate them. It's exactly what alcohol did to me. Changed me from a frightened, angry, timid, stupid, ugly little boy into one hell of a fine man in about three drinks. Okay. I don't have any question that they were correct. For centuries they've been calling alcohol spirits. It produces a sense of well-being and a sense of being here now. It produces what seems to be a spiritual awakening. But I found that anything I can take from the outside and put in here is transient. It can and will and does go away. There's no permanence to it. I have found since you taught me how that what I find in here is mine. You can't take it from me. We can argue over technicalities, but we never argue over what really happened. And I can tell you what really happened to me. In fact, that's what I'll do this morning. And nobody can argue with that. It may not have happened to you, but it happened to me. And well, it changed me. Forever it changed me. That evening, it was all right for me to be done. And that evening, I had plans. That's one of the differences between my alcoholic mind and my sane mind. In my alcoholic mind, I'm a reactor. Life happens and I bounce off of it. I quickly reach for some kind of script to tell me what the hell I'm supposed to say or do or not do. By the time I find the right script, the action's already moved on. So I'm doing scene two with scene one's script. No wonder I feel inappropriate. It causes me to laugh at funerals and cry at hockey games. I'm in the wrong arena most of the time. Trying to figure out what is it you want me to be. Well, I found out something about what you want me to be. You mostly don't give a damn. I remember sitting in my prison cell one day with one of those flashes of truth came by me, and that there were people on this planet that loved me no matter what I did. And there are people on this planet that don't like me at all, no matter what I do. Most of the people on this planet don't even care if I show up. And I knew I'm sane. Okay? Most of them don't care whether I show up or not. And that's as it should be. Well, over a period of years, alcoholism took me down some strange paths, and finally, I just ran out of steam. Christmas week of 1967, I was down to 133 pounds. My little boy's mother had taken off when Terry was 2 1/2 and Sean was 1, and we had been literally on the road for about 4 1/2 years because Dad was restless, irritable, and discontent. And we'd hit somewhere, and I'd tried with all my heart to be a good father. And in about a month, we had to move. And we just tried it over and over again. I'd never had a DUI because most of the time we didn't have a car. I walked this country with the boys and a sea bag and a couple of suitcases and a heart full of pain. And I drank. Christmas week of 1967, the phenomenal thing I needed to have happen happened. Now, I didn't hit bottom, as I hear. A lot of the stuff I hear in AA, I don't understand. So if I sound funny, please just know I don't understand. I hit bottom when I was 19 years old. I've never hit a worse bottom than I did at that. Because bottom for me is that time when I wake up in the morning and realize that everything I had in mind for my life up to now, it's not going to happen. Scrap it, start over. And I did that so often, it's hard to locate it. Surrender was easy for me. I've been doing that all the time. You just lay down your fighting tools because you've met something you can't beat. Then you sit by the side of the road and wait till something comes by and tells you where to go next. I've been doing that all my life. So when I came to AA, I surrendered. What the hell? That's easy. I just complied with whatever you said to do, I did it. If you're new here tonight, please be careful of that. If you want what we have, do what we do. If you don't want what we have, don't do what we do, because you'll get it. This is an incredible deal. If you do this, and if you're new and you're worried about, am I going to do it right? Don't worry. You're not. It doesn't matter. If you're doing it at all, it works. I've seen it work for people who are deliberately not doing it. It works anyway. It works better if you cooperate, though. Anyway, what happened that week is that I ran out of lies. I didn't get sober because of the truth. I got sober because I ran out of lies. I got well because of the truth. The lies were simple. I'd have told you that I was a pretty good father still. 133-pound speed freak who was stealing during the day to get enough booze to go to sleep at night. But we're doing pretty well. We have a place to live, and it's warm and clean. We have food. That was crap. I was on federal parole for a little indiscretion I committed in 1966. We were on aid to dependent children because I couldn't work. And we lived in a hovel down in the basement beneath a lady that raised cats, and she had cats everywhere, and her place was cleaner than mine was. And I began to see that kind of thing. Coming from the home I came from, I know what Christmas is supposed to look like, and it didn't look like that in my house. Christmas is a marvelous time in a sane home. They'd bring a tree in from the outside, a real tree, smelled like spruce. And we'd decorate it with lights and tinsel, and we'd thread popcorn on, we'd sew popcorn together, is what it looked like to me. And the house smelled good. There was cider with cinnamon sticks in it, and hot chocolate with marshmallows. And I'm talking about real marshmallows, not those sissy things. The ones that melt across the top and you have to go before you can drink the chocolate. And the most painful memory when I thought about that and still think about that is what really happened at Christmas in my home where I grew up is that people came by to visit. Probably the most important human activity that I am currently aware of is that I have learned how to visit. It's really hard for alcoholics. In order to visit, you have to be at least as interested in the other person as you are in yourself. Okay? We just don't do that well. People love my parents, and still do. And they would come by and visit. Hell, nobody came by my house in 1967. Even my parole officer made me visit him. He wouldn't come by. We were lonely people because I had made us alone. I thought I was alone, and I finally created a world where that was true. I believe in magic. And we walked on Christmas, on the 24th, we took a walk. We always had to walk. I could not sit still. And we found a dollar in the snow and took that to the Christmas tree place. We didn't have a tree because the welfare check hadn't gotten there yet. We didn't have any money. And they sold us the biggest tree on the lot for a dollar that day. And I keep that memory intact. There's a little pain with it. I love it. Because the tree was about 9 feet tall, and the ceiling was about 7 feet tall. And it tilted over. And we dressed it with garbage, because that's what we had. Cut the bottom off of one of those little milk cartons, and it makes a bell, and you can... We just decorated it. A very kind man at the Public Merchandise Mart in Denver gave me a pair of cowboy boots and a shirt on credit, so each of my kids had one present. And my boys had wrapped up everything that would fit in blue paper towel and put it on the table under the tree for me. And of course, that cracked me. There's something wrong here. On Christmas Day, we went down to my folks' place to spend the day with Grandma and Grandpa. It never occurred to me that that couldn't happen. When we got there, Dad met us at the door and he said, "Don, I'm sorry, but your mother said I can't let you in here anymore. She can't stand watching you die." Now, I would have told you that day, leave me the hell alone. I'm not hurting anybody but me. And I saw the lie standing at that door. I was hurting everybody I'd ever met. I saw what I'd done to my people and to my kids and to everybody I knew. And the lie just disintegrated. And then my dad destroyed my last lie because he snuck us into the basement. Don't do that, Joyce. Get me doing that. We're in trouble up here. Anyway, I believe that day that nobody cared. Nobody loved us. That's what I told you. Well, my dad made a lie out of that. He did. But I didn't have any lies left. So I went home with a heart full of self-pity. And then I walked past the self-pity into the truth. And the truth for me that day, and please, if you're in, don't be afraid of this one, it's the departure point. On that day, the truth was, there was no reason for me to be on this planet. I was totally useless. I could think of no possible use for me in my life. You cannot live in that state. Don't linger. There's only really one alternative. I still say there's two. You either surrender or you die. There's no other way. And I was surrendered out. I had nothing left to surrender to. I have tried everything along the way. I've tried psychiatry. I knew L. Ron Hubbard. I went into Dianetics back in 53. Now, there's good alcoholic thinking. Your life's a mess. You just got out of your first penitentiary with a bad conduct discharge from the Navy, and nobody wants to talk to you. Turn your own your life over to the care of a science fiction writer. That makes sense. Not for me. I've been baptized several times. If I take it from the outside and put it in here to make me feel better, it will be temporary. I had nothing left to surrender to. Didn't have any hope, just the truth. And the truth was, the kids would be better off if I wasn't there. They'd take them someplace where somebody would care for them, who cared about them. I loved them deeply, but in my warped, total self-centeredness, I couldn't care for them. So I did the only thing I could do. I took a 2-month supply of the garbage I was currently using and shot it up my arm and drank everything in the house and lay down and died. And I haven't had a drink since. He's dead. He's gone. It's over. My first spiritual awakening did not feel good. I was reborn, and it felt just like that. Everything hurt. Because when I woke up in the morning, not only did my body hurt, my mind hurt. I was in a wonderful state, a complete failure at living and a complete failure at dying. It really put you there. Okay? I laid down all my fighting tools. I now was willing to go anywhere anybody said and do anything anybody said. That meant I didn't have to be me anymore. And the police came. God's angels did not look like angels that morning. Nor did they talk nice to me. They were really pissed at me. They came with 9 charges, and the first one called for 3 years to life. The Denver district attorney told me that he'd bring the others one at a time if I beat that, but I was through. And I still owed the federal government 5 years on that little mistake in 1966. I was through, and I really didn't care. I just went where they told me. Laid up in the Denver County Jail on detox, and don't want to ever forget that. I had 6 weeks of true detox. Cramps and headaches and the whole thing. It was wonderful. I don't for a minute believe that the memory of that would keep me sober. I've had worse than that. But that has made me a pretty good sponsor. See, if you come to me at the end of 5 weeks of cramps and pain and headache and teeth gnashing and say, I'm going to die, I can say to you with absolute certainty, not yet. You've got a week to go. God's been very kind. Nobody's had to go past the 6th week. I don't know what I'm going to say. If you come in the middle of the 6th week and say the same thing to me, I'll send you to Keith. There was a 5-month healing time that was necessary for me before I was sent to you. Don't pretend to know why, I just know that's the truth. For 5 months, I laid in jail and healed. God sends me the wounded animals too. Wounded people need time to heal. I'm a big book fanatic. I believe in the big book process, but I also believe sometimes we've got to nurse these folks along for a while before they can hear that. And our founders told us that. It's imperative that a man's mind be cleared first. And that may take 5 days, that may take 5 months. I've got a couple of them that's taken 5 years. So we nurse them. The power of God went to work in my life right then. I didn't understand God, didn't know the Word. I just know that looking back, the power of God went to work. Because when we came to court on my trial date, they took me in a little room with my lawyer and said, we've been talking with the federal people, and we've all concluded you are really sick. So what's the point? Well, I know that. I've known that for years. They said, if you'll plead guilty to this little reduced charge we have ready for you, so we don't have to have this messy trial, because it would have been a messy one, they said, we'll give you a 1.5 to 3-year sentence and then suspend it and give you back to the feds. They've agreed to take you. I owed them 5 years anyway. And they'll take you to the hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, and fix what's wrong with you. I signed right there. I'm drunk, not an idiot. 2 things went off in my mind. There are always at least 2 of me at work. If you're worried about the voices inside, get to know them. They ain't going anywhere. Get friendly. I knew if you put me in a hospital with doctors and books, that I would be on the street in 6 months. I know the process. They would tell me what was wrong with me. They would tell me about how long they expected to take to fix that. They would tell me clearly all of the symptoms I'd have to show them to convince them I was getting better. We're playing my game now. I've been doing that since I was little. The other side of me, I was truly willing to go anywhere anybody said, and so I signed, and the deal was made, and I went to court, and I pled guilty, and they reduced the charge, and gave me 1.5 to 3, and suspended it, and gave me back to the federal people who'd already agreed to take me. 5 days later, I was in the fish tank in the Colorado State Penitentiary. By the grace of a loving God, I had truly surrendered, and I was brought to you. Because here's where I belong. And you didn't look all that nifty to me. They sent 3 guys over with numbers on their chest, green uniforms and numbers. I didn't have a name at the time. I was 38-984. That was back when they still took your name away from you. You lost it. God got up, these 3 guys. Now, understand that convicts in their natural habitat make you a little nervous. Smiling convicts are intimidating as hell. These guys had that smile that says, we know something you don't know, and if you don't hear it the first time, you may not live long enough to hear it the second time. So they said, you'll come down and listen. And we did. We came down. I didn't have anything better to do that day, so I listened. And if you're new, that's all this is about. Listen. God has made me a listener. Keith and I have talked about this. We think it's funny that we have to talk so much. We're listeners. What I heard was this. The guy got up and he said, my name is Doc, and I'm an alcoholic. And that means that I am powerless over alcohol and guards and drugs and all of the circumstances in my life, and my life has become unmanageable. And if any of you smart bastards think you can still manage your lives, look at the reward the state just gave you for the nifty job you've been doing. Truth without love is cruelty. Confrontation without a real answer is brutality. But these people loved us as we were, where we were, before they ever knew our names. And they had a real answer, so never was I given anything but just the clean, straight ahead on truth. I said to Bruce one time, Bruce, I'm terrified of my mind. He said, you have good reason to be. That's the truth. There was no Mickey Mouse in there. I have been continuously sober since December 26th of 1967, and the reason I tell you that is not to glorify me or AA. It's to help you, if you're new here, get past one of the new myths in AA. The truth is, relapse is not part of recovery. It's not necessary. If you're an alcoholic, you don't ever have to drink again. We can promise you that. Some of you will relapse. I don't give a damn. But you don't have to. I haven't had to. For 20 years, he hadn't had to. I run around with people 45 and 50 years sober. They haven't had to. The guy who told me that did. He drank again. My first sponsor drank. The one who had more influence on my life than anybody else. But he's the one who taught me, don't worry about what anybody else does. What are you going to do? I didn't take it from the outside and put it in. He showed me how to open up inside for myself. He was an interesting man. If I'd have had to identify with what it was like and what he had done, I wouldn't be here. Because in a drunken rage when he was 17 years old, this man killed a couple people in a shootout. In a robbery in downtown Denver. I'm a sneak thief. I'm not a gun toter. God, I learned real early. If you put a gun in your hand, somebody thinks you may use it and they start shooting back at you. Yeah. Not me. Keep me with pens are my weapon. I write really interesting documents. Oh, well. Never mind, the statute may not be up on that one. Bruce talked about what he felt like that morning, what happened to him that morning, and that I identified with. He woke up with a feeling that nobody cared whether he lived or died. And the pain of that was such that he took his medicine to kill the pain, and that day it didn't work. It intensified the pain. And there's only one legitimate response to that kind of being alone where nobody cares. Rage. And drunken rage, he killed some people. Well, I'd done my own bizarre stuff, but I identified with that. Particularly the drinking. Well, he'd been in a penitentiary since he was 17 years old, and in his, I think he did 9, 10, 11 years, and they paroled him out. as spiritual a human being as I've ever met. I watched. He walked the walk. 3 weeks later, he was drunk. And I've talked with him since. It's real simple. What got him was, where's mine? I missed something between here and there. And couldn't do what he had to do without drinking. And he drank. It took him 9 years to get home. But he's the one who taught me and said, here, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. It's what I do. They told me about the disease of alcoholism. I have it. I was in my first federal penitentiary when I was 19 because when I drink, I get lost and can't find my way home. And at that time, I was in the Navy, and that's a felony. They gave me a 24-hour liberty, and I came back 23 days later. Off a drunk. And in the doctor's opinion, I'm described right to the T. Talks about men who'd been working on a business deal would be settled favorably to them on a certain date. They had a drink a day or two before and they missed their appointment. I had a 24-hour liberty. My appointment was due at 24 hours. I had a drink of alcohol in Long Beach, California, and 23 days later was in Pershing Square in Los Angeles drinking. When suddenly I didn't have to do that anymore and I went back to the ship. But for 22 days, I had to do that. I had no choice. I'm absolutely appalled when I go to AA meetings and somebody comes back after drinking and I hear someone say, well, they must have wanted to drink more than they wanted to stay sober. It appalls me. It shows a terrible lack of understanding, I think. If they had a choice, they sure as hell wouldn't have done that. There's no choice involved here. Once I start, the choice is gone. And unfortunately, there's no choice anyway. From the time I took my first drink, I've never had a choice. 28 years sober, I did not choose not to drink this morning. That choice has never been given back to me, thank God. Every time I had the choice, I made the wrong one. Whether I drink or not is none of my business. I gave that to God. If God isn't big enough to handle it, I'm cooked. I kind of believe he is. I came to believe in the power of God because I saw it walking around. There was nothing esoteric or out there in the clouds about it. There were three men who had been totally changed. That's all I came for. I didn't know I needed sobriety because I didn't know I was alcoholic, but I knew I needed to be changed. Bruce didn't kill people anymore. Couldn't. Even in that state, I knew when he told me that story, the guy telling me the story was not the man who had done the deed. A different human being. He couldn't kill anymore. And I asked him about that. He said, that's right, I've been changed, and God changed me. I didn't care who changed him. I just knew he'd been changed. Roy Nichols couldn't stick people up and take their stuff away from them anymore. He'd been changed. Old Phil Gutierrez taught me about love. God loved Phil. He came to us from Guam when he was 17 because they couldn't contain him on the island anymore. I met him in the Colorado State Penitentiary after he'd been there for 7 years because Colorado couldn't contain him either. Now here's this sweetheart of a man. Mean looking dude. And just a mean looking dude. But Phil's the one who taught me how to touch physically in a penitentiary. Where that's a little risky. But Phil's touching was of the spiritual kind and you knew it. Phil was healing. He knew we're all a bunch of puppies. And we need patted and petted. And what do? Here in AA? Yeah, we just pat and pet the hell out of each other. Keep it up. Please, I need it. He had been changed. Phil was doing time down there because on his last drunk, he threw some people out of a 3-story window. That's the kind of guy Phil was. He was changed. He was soft and gentle and kind. and tougher than hell. Phil would not budge on principle. Anyway, these guys were an example to me of the power of God in the flesh, walking around. And so I just did what they said. I figured, okay. My sponsor did not give me a new concept of God. Thank God. He destroyed all my old ones. Deliberately. Took me aside one afternoon. Put me into shape. We had come to the idea, first of all, he said, you're not a sociopath and a psychopath, you're just a good actor. We found out what kind of insanity I suffer from in the story of the car salesman named Jim. We thought he could put an ounce of whiskey in his milk and be all right. The book says whatever the precise definition of the word, we call that plain insanity. How can this lack of proportion in the ability to think straight be anything else? That's what I suffer from, lack of proportion. A lack of the ability to think straight. I cannot to this day on my own think straight. Everything gets filtered through my ego, which warps it. It's only by letting God direct my thinking that I can think straight. That's another 24-hour talk. All of my ideas of God at that time had to do with Santa Claus and what's he going to do for me. I stand here before you this morning and tell you that the value of my life today is that I quit saying, do this for me, God. I've learned to say, what can I do for you? And the difference is, I'm here this morning. But I had to get rid of all those old Santa Claus ideas, and he just wiped them out. I was furious that day. I can still remember yelling at him. You're asking me now to surrender to nothing because I had nothing left. He laughed and said, why not? Nothing can run your life better than you've been doing. God, he's a smart ass. Then he went for the heart because he knew I had one final reservation. I really believed at that time that if I gave my life entirely over to the care of God, he had work for me to do. That's what you kept saying. I didn't want to do it because I knew what it was. If I truly surrendered, I'd end up at the corner of Colfax and Broadway in Denver handing out Watchtower magazines and asking perfect strangers, have you been saved, brother? And I'd watch the guy doing that. I couldn't see me doing that. And I told him that, and he said those magic words. Let's talk about that. If you're new here, I need to tell you, let's talk about that does not mean let us talk about that. No. It means listen. And because he had a real answer, he went for the heart. He said, Don, do you suppose that the guy that's handing out Watchtowers this morning had breakfast where he wanted to? And I said, probably. And he said, well, you didn't. Do you suppose that guy that's humiliating himself down there on the corner is wearing clothes that he picked out to do it in? And I said, probably. And he said, you're not. Do you suppose when he's all through, making a fool of himself, that he gets to go home? I didn't. We are promised here a new mind. The old one's too badly damaged, they can't fix it. I'm promised a new one, and my sponsor hand-carried me into it and laid the foundation. And the foundation of my new mind is very simple. Anything at all that God may have in mind for me is better than anything at all that I will ever have in mind for me. Period. Doesn't mean I don't get dreams and aspirations. I just check them out first. I really lived that way and have for 28 years now. It's been an adventure. I do it imperfectly. Sometimes I'm clawing and kicking and screaming. I've called him a bully one day. Well, God doesn't care what you call him as long as you do. Seems to be big enough to handle bully. Let me tell you the contrast. It's so easy for me to see the contrast. When I ran my life, when I gave it every ounce of everything I had in me, everything, I ended up living in an 8x10 toilet talking to cockroaches, and my children were in a foster home, and my mother was not able to see me on Christmas Day. That's the very best I can do. Since I gave it to God, whatever He has in mind, my God, the world has become mine. I have been all over this world, literally, since then. I've been to Russia, I've been to Guatemala, to Puerto Rico, and Canada, and the United States. My God, look at me this morning. I'm in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. If I'd have made a list of places to go, y'all wouldn't have been on it. And that's not because this is a bad place to go. It would never have occurred to me that in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, was what my heart desired the most. That's the truth. You've given me something this morning I didn't have when I got here. So I'm going to let God decide where I go. I picked tall, willowy, sexy blonde, very needy types. Wore me out. I quit doing that and said, why don't you pick the next one, boy? In fact, if it's all the same to you, I don't even need one. I lived at the base of a 14,000-foot mountain with the Arkansas River in the front yard, two teenage boys, a black dog, and a white cat, worked at the reformatory 6 hours a day, and the rest of my life was mine. So I could honestly say to God, I really don't care if somebody interrupts this deal or not. This is pretty good living. And 2 weeks later, I met a sane lady. A little dark-headed Italian lady who didn't need me at all. We have been successfully married for 19 years without one fight. We're not always agree. But you taught me something. If I start to defend my position and my voice goes up that much, I'm already wrong. So I never disagree with her. She thinks I'm the cutest thing she's ever seen. I agree. I honestly, God, get frustrated here. I have been living hand in hand, fully conscious of the presence of God in my life, as my life, for 28 years, which means that every day of that, something incredible has happened, and I want to tell you about it, and I'm already just about out of time. And I can't tell you about all of it. I've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to use it to tell you some really important things that are, in my experience, living the spiritual life. You just heard one of them. We hear about commitment here. My commitment to my wife is simple. I married her because I want to grow old with her. That's the reason. Love wasn't enough. It's a good start. That wasn't enough. What happens when the plumbing doesn't work? I'm going to be there. In fact, I told her, here's the commitment. If you want me out, you're going to have to put my stuff on the porch and call the sheriff, because I ain't going. Now, that's commitment. There are days when it hasn't seemed like the best choice. She also had two little girls that I got to raise. And I'd already raised seven, and I'd done my fair share. These girls' daddy was a Denver vice squad detective. Never said a bad word against the man. Don't have any bad words to say against him. Don't have any words much at all. I got to raise those kids. And I didn't want to do that, but let me tell you a little story that I'd have missed. From here on, I just want you to understand, please don't miss these kinds of things, because this is what sobriety is about. I love working with my drunks, but the life behind it is what this is about. My little one, I've got a really mouthy one, stepdaughter, Kelly. Boy, she's a political activist, and she'll up in your face in a flat second. I just love her to pieces. But we didn't always get along too good, because I'm a little mouthy. And I don't have opinions, I'm right. So, we had some interesting discussions over the years. She had occasion when she was about 12 to have to write a piece at school on her dad. And she picked me. And she put my picture on this thing and did, you know how they are when they're 12, put this book together. And I got to read that, and it was 7 pages of some of the neatest stuff I had ever seen. I was really glad to know me that day. If you never get a chance to see yourself through someone else's eyes, good or bad, it's really a trip. But her last paragraph rocked me. She said, if I would have had a choice, I would have picked Don for my dad. But I didn't have a choice. So God picked him and brought him to me. I understood that. That's what that one meant to you. If I had a choice, I'd have picked you, but I didn't have any choice. So God picked you and brought me to you. You don't want to miss things like that. One morning, I promised Kelly I'd tell you this one. One morning after my morning meditation, probably the best one in all these years, I just kind of moving half inch off the floor through the house. And Kelly and Lisa were in the kitchen, early teens, and I don't know if you've been around two girls. Damn, they can get mean-mouthed. And they were mean-mouthing each other. And I did a really stupid thing. I said quietly from my lofty perch, please don't do that. And I didn't know that in little girl talk, that means, oh, Daddy wants in the game. So, the volume went up. And I got my feet back on the floor and did another really stupid thing. I said, knock it off out there. Which means, oh, we got him now. So they went berserk. And since I'm in the game, I went berserk. I said, get to your rooms. And they ran up the stairs going, tee hee hee. And my house, because the spiritual life requires some solitude and privacy, if the doors are closed, unless the house is on fire, we won't mess with you. It's really important. So they went into their rooms and slammed their doors. Oh, I bounded with a single leap. screaming at the top of my lungs, if we're going to slam them, we're not going to have them, and I'm taking the doors off the hinges. And they're laughing and carrying on. And I tear the doors down to the basement, and they went on to school. And I hit the basement stairs. The doors were much heavier than they were upstairs. And that thing in my head that guides me said, "Well, dummy, you've done it again. You gotta carry these right back up there. Rehang them. And then when those little girls get home, you have to apologize. Hell, I hadn't done anything." Anything in my character that will separate me from my children also separates me from God. Anything that separates me from you separates me from God. And so this became a really critical thing that I had done. It's fun to talk about. But my life was on the line, and others' lives are on the line. So I did what I've been taught. I wrote down the reasons that that threatened me. Why would their behavior threaten me? And I found it total self-centeredness. They were creating a stir in my sanctuary, in my home. How dare they disrupt the peace and harmony of my home? I'd forgotten they lived there too. So we did the inventory, I did the fifth step with my sponsor, we talked about it, I made the amends, I apologized to them. And to finish off the amends, what I do now when they get out of hand, I send myself to my room. It's a whole lot easier. This is Mother's Day, and I want to tell you how I watched God take the very worst thing I have ever done in my mind and turn it into a tool of healing for hundreds and hundreds of people. It took a long time to get square with my mom. How do you say, "Mom, I wish I hadn't made it necessary for you to tell me to go away on Christmas Day with the kids"? There's no possible way I could have figured that out. You taught me what I have to do is listen while the people tell me how to get square, and I become a listener. And months after I got out, my mother let me come by the house very reluctantly. And I truly, my approach to amends is simple. I've harmed you, I know that. Here's what I think I did and what I think I ought to do to fix it. Now, will you please tell me what I really have to do so we can get square? And I found a way to ask her that, and she said, "Honey, all I've ever wanted for you is that you be happy." So for the last 26 or so years, I've been going by my mom's house on a regular basis happy. The deal is regular, and it worked. And as a result of patching that back up, as I say, I travel a lot. And I think the worst thing I ever did, bar none, was the day out of my own greed and need and meanness, I stole her $2 bill collection so I could get drunk. She didn't even know it because it was tucked away back somewhere. I didn't have the nerve to go steal from anybody else. It just ate me up. Well, when I came around to trying to straighten that up, back in the late 60s and early 70s, they took $2 bills off the market. They weren't being used. So all I could do was tell her about it and own up to it, but I couldn't replace them. 7 years ago, my God, it must be 10 years now, I had occasion to be down in Charlottesville, West Virginia, or Virginia, anyway, at Tom Jefferson's place, and found that they were back in circulation. They had cases of them there that were, you could get them for change for souvenirs because Jefferson's picture's on the $2 bill. So I bought 16 bills to replace the ones I had stolen. I loved to get a crowd response, so I told them about it, and we all had a good cry. Took them home and gave them to Mom, and the deal was done. And 2 weeks later, in the mail from down there in West Virginia, no return address, I got a letter filled with $2 bills. And I got to have the experience of anonymity. I got to be touched by what was happening. That's how it is with us sometimes. It's not the direct. Somebody else had done that. And for whatever the reason, they could not make direct amends and they could not get free. So by coming through me to my mom, somebody else got free. I became the channel that I've always wanted to be. And in the last 10 years, I can't tell you the number of bills that she's gotten. I quit telling the story. Somebody said to me one time, if you keep telling that, she's going to be a rich woman. And they keep coming. And what my mother does with those is even more powerful, I think. My sister says she uses that to tell people about AA. She thinks we're really strange. She likes us, but we're strange. She said people will come over and she'll bring out these two collections. She's got the ones, the 16 I gave her, plus one I gave later. Somewhere I woke up to the fact you go one past that. And then she drags out the other one. And the bills that you all give her, she doesn't straighten out and put in neat piles. She keeps them as they come. Some are crumpled, some are folded. One was made into an origami bird. She puts a little paper clip on them, where they came from. She's got them now from Samoa, Canada, the United States. And she brings these out, and she says, each one of these, because this is what I told her, each one of these represents someone being free a terminal disease. Somebody getting free in their spirit. And then she says, and my son's part of that. Don't miss it. Last thing is fresh. We've had to put Dad in the home finally. He's just too much for her. They think he has Alzheimer's. I think they're crazy. There's nothing wrong with him. He's just tired. God, he's 86 years old, and he's worn himself to a frazzle. And his memory's not so good anymore. He's smarter than I am, but his memory isn't too good. But anyway, we had a big family conference with the doctors and all that, and it was decided that it is best that he be there in the home. He also had to have some lower tract taken out, so my brother and sister, bless their sane hearts, think that he can't eat the same thing he used to. It's not good for him. He's 86 years old and dying. Let him eat whatever the hell he wants. It's too late. So I sneak him in bad food. Oh, yeah. I bring the Cheetos in and they sneak him out again. I bring him back in. Anyway, at this meeting, he asked the doctor, he said, can I please have some chili? He loves chili. And she's with me. She says, Mr. Pritch, you just eat anything you want. So we took him to Denny to have chili that day. The whole family's sitting around. I'm sitting next to him and we're visiting. And they tell me he's been doing funny things with his food, like putting mayonnaise in the lemonade and stuff. And I've never seen that. They just tell me that's what he's doing. So we're visiting, and I've noticed he's eating his chili like an old man does, real slow. And then he picked up one of those grape jelly containers and was opening it, and I thought, oh my God, he's getting ready to put jelly in the chili. In Denny's. So I thought I'd finesse him. I got a hold of a muffin, and I put it over under him, and said, you know, Pop, I believe that tastes better if you put it on this. So I took a spoonful of chili and put it on the plate. Then he looked me right in the eye. The eye that said, gotcha. That's what it's about to me. I don't want to miss those moments. See, my dad's going to die soon. And I want to be current with him today. But when he goes, I don't have to stand in a grave and say, I wish I'd have said this, Pop. I wish I'd have done this. But I can tell you to the best of my knowledge, there is no one on earth that I will have to mourn over a grave and mourn what I didn't do. I will mourn their passing. But as of this morning, to the best of my knowledge, I'm square with y'all. Now is the time we can have fun, because now we can go the one extra. After all the serious stuff we have to do here, the main thing we do here is let's have some fun. I've been asked to close with a story I haven't used for years, so I will. No, I won't either. I found a better one. My little brother and I took 22 years to make peace. I really damaged my little brother. I was his hero. But I betrayed everything there was about that. Everything. I hurt our family, I hurt him, I hurt me. My brother had a hard time even talking to me for years. 22 years sober, he had my wife and I over for dinner, and when we were all through, he said, Don, I'm not sure you and I could ever be friends. But this was nice. We can do this again. And so over a period of time, it began to develop. Well, I had occasion to be in North Carolina for 2 years, and I'd visit home frequently, and when I go home, I stop by the folks' place. That's what I do. And he came in, and we were sitting there visiting, and suddenly he kicked me on the bottom of the shoe, and he said, Don, you know, I'm really glad to see you. And he really was. He said, listen, next time you're in town, let you and I go up to the cabin. We have a little cabin up near Fairfield, Colorado. We'll do some fishing. Well, I made a trip. And he and I went to the cabin. We did a little bit of fishing. We just scared some brookies. There to fish. We went back to the cabin and played cribbage and talked. Now, I am scrupulously honest in all of my activities except games. And cribbage is an institution game, and he forgot that. I did the only thing that's reasonable to do under those circumstances. I reminded him that it had been years since I'd played cribbage, and that he would probably have to teach me how to count all over again. And that, you know, what I did was get him playing both hands, and you can't lose if you do that. You know. Creamed him. And we talked. My little brother gave me that day the most precious gift I have ever been given. It's the most precious gift any of us can give to anyone else. He took from within himself who he thought he was, and he showed that to me. You don't just do that to anybody. He said, Don, I want you to know something. I said, I'm 58 years old, and I believe I have made a decent contribution to life. What a precious gift. Oh, my goodness. And the other part of the gift for me is that I've been trying for years to find some way, and the Statue of David story was one of the ways. I'm trying to find a way to tell you precisely how I feel about you. Well, this morning, I'm 62 years old. And because of you, I believe I've been able to make a decent contribution to life. Thank you.